Craig had the first shift from 9 in the morning, when the 2,000 invited guests started arriving, until 11, when Craig would hand over to a cousin and assume his other duties as Roland's best man. Craig had helped the old man dress in his uniform from the Kaiser's War. A local tailor had been brought out to King's Lynn to make the alterations, and the results were surprising. Bawu looked dapper and spry with his Sam Brown belt and swagger stick, and the double row of coloured ribbons on his chest. Craig was proud of him as he took up his position on the front veranda and looked over the crowded lawns, lifting his swagger stick in acknowledgement of the affectionate cries of "Hello, Uncle Bawu!" brushing out his gleaming silver moustaches and tipping the peak of his cap at a more debonair angle over one eye. "Damn me, boy," he told Craig. "This whole business makes me feel quite romantic again. I haven't been married myself for nearly 20 years. I've a good mind to give it one last whirl." "There's always the widow, Angus," Craig suggested, and his grandfather was outraged. "That old crow? Bawu, she's rich and only 50. "That's old, boy. Catch 'em young and train 'em well, that's my motto." Bawu winked at him. "Now, how about that one?" His choice was 25 years old, twice divorced already, wearing an unfashionable miniskirt and casting a bold eye about her. "You can introduce me," Bawu gave his magnanimous permission. I think the Prime Minister wants to see you, Bawu." Craig searched desperately for a distraction before the pert little bottom under the miniskirt was soundly pinched. Craig had seen the old man flirting before. He left Bawu, gin and tonic in hand, giving Ian Smith a few tips on international diplomacy. "You have to remember that these fellows, Callaghan and his friends, are all working class, Ian, my boy. You cannot treat them like gentlemen. They wouldn't understand that." And the Prime Minister, worn and tired and wan with his responsibilities, one eyelid drooping, his curly, sandy hair receding, tried to hide his smile as he nodded.
"Quite right, Uncle Bawu. I remember that."
Craig felt safe to leave him for 10 minutes, sure that the old man's opinions of the British Labour government were good for at least that long, and he made his way swiftly through the crowds to where Janine's parents stood, with a small group, at the end of the veranda. He insinuated himself unobtrusively into the circle, and studied Janine's mother out of the corner of his eye. It gave him a hollow, aching feeling to recognise the same features, the jawline and deep forehead blurred only marginally by the passage of time. She had the same slanted eyes, with the same appealing cat-like cast to them. She caught his gaze and smiled at him.
"Mrs. Carpenter, I'm a good friend of Janine's. My name's Craig Mellor."
"Oh, yes. Jan wrote about you in her letters." Her smile was warm, and her voice had haunting echoes of her daughter's. Craig found himself babbling away to her, and could not prevent it, until softly and compassionately she said, "She told me you were such a nice person. I am sorry, I truly am."
I don't understand," Craig stiffened.
"You love her very much, don't you?" He stared at her miserably, unable to reply, and she touched his arm in understanding.
"Excuse me," he blurted. "Roland will be ready to dress. I must go."
He stumbled and almost fell on the veranda steps.
"By God, Sonny, where have you been? I thought you were going to let me go into contact on my own," Roland shouted from the shower. "Have you got the ring?"
They waited side by side under the bower of fresh flowers in front of the makeshift altar, which also was smothered with flowers. Roland wore full-dress uniform, the maroon beret with Butso's head, cap badge, the colonel's crowns on his shoulders, the silver cross for valour on his breast, white gloves on his hands, and the gilt and tasselled sword at his waist. In his simple police uniform, Craig felt gauche and drab, like a sparrow beside a golden eagle, like a tabby cat beside a leopard, and the waiting seemed to go on forever. Through it all, Craig clung to a hopeless notion that it was still not going to happen. That was the only way he could hold his despair at bay. Then there was the triumphant swell of the bridal march, and down both sides of the carpeted aisle from the house, the crowd stirred and hummed with excitement and anticipation. Craig felt his soul begin the final plunge into cold and darkness, He could not bring himself to look round. He stared straight ahead at the face of the priest. He had known him since childhood, but now he seemed a stranger. His face swam and wavered in Craig's vision. Then he smelt Janine. Even over the scent of the altar flowers, he recognized her perfume, and he almost choked on the memories it evoked. He felt the train of her dress brush against his ankle, and he moved back slightly and turned so that he could see her for the last time. She was on her father's arm. The veil covered her hair and misted her face. But beneath its soft folds he could see her eyes, those great slanted eyes, the dark indigo of a tropical sea shining softly as she looked up at Roland Ballantyne. "Dearly beloved, we are gathered together here in the sight of God and in the face of his church, to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony." Now Craig could not take his eyes from her face. She had never looked so lovely. She wore a crown of fresh violets, the exact colour of her eyes. He still hoped that it would not happen, that something would prevent it. "Therefore, if any man can show any just cause why they may not lawfully be joined together, let him now speak." He wanted to call out, to stop it. He wanted to shout, "I love her. She's mine." But his throat was so dry and painful that he could not draw breath enough through it. Then it was happening. "I, Roland Morris, take thee, Janine Elizabeth, to have and to hold from this day forward." Rowley's voice was clear and strong, and it raked Craig's soul to its very depths. After that, nothing else mattered. Craig seemed to be standing a little way from it all, as though all the laughter and joy was on the other side of a glass partition. The voices were strangely muted. Even the light seemed dulled, as though a cloud had passed across the sun. He watched from the back of the crowd, standing under the jacaranda trees, while Janine came out onto the veranda, still carrying her bouquet of violets, dressed in her blue going-away ensemble. She and Roland were still hand in hand, but now he lifted her onto a tabletop, and there were feminine shrieks of excitement as Janine poised to toss her bouquet. In that moment, she looked over their heads and saw Craig. The smile stayed on her lovely wide mouth, but something moved in her eyes, a dark shadow, perhaps of pity, perhaps even regret. Then she threw the bouquet. One of her bridesmaids caught it, and Roland swept her down and away. Hand in hand, the two of them ran down the lawns to where the helicopter waited with its rotor already turning. They ran laughing, Janine clutching her wide-brimmed straw hat, and Roland trying to shield her from the storm of confetti that swirled around them. Craig did not wait for the machine to bear them away. He returned to where he had left the old Land Rover at the back of the stables. He drove back to the yacht. He stripped off his uniform, threw it onto the bunk, and pulled on a pair of silk jogging shorts. He went into the galley and from the refrigerator hooked out a can of beer. Sipping the froth, he went back into the saloon. A loner all his life, he had believed himself immune to the tortures of loneliness, and now he knew that he had been mistaken. By this time there was a stack of over 50 exercise books upon the saloon table, each of them filled from cover to cover with his pencilled scrawl. He sat down and selected a pencil from the bunch stuck into an empty coffee mug like porcupine quills. He began to write. And slowly the corrosive agony of loneliness receded and became merely a slow, dull ache. On Monday morning, when Craig walked into police headquarters, on his way through to the armory, the member in charge called him into the office.
"Craig, I've got movement papers for you. You're being detached on special assignment."
"Oh, what is it?"
"Hell, I don't know. I just work here. Nobody tells me anything. But you are ordered to report to the area commander, Wanky, on the 28th. The inspector broke off and studied Craig's face.
"Are you feeling okay, Craig?"
"Yes.
Why do you ask?"
"You're looking bloody awful, man." He considered for a few moments. "I tell you what, if you sneak away from here on the 25th, you could give yourself a couple of days' break before reporting to your new assignment."
"You are the only star in my firmament, George," Craig grinned lopsidedly, and thought to himself, "That's all I need. 3 days with nothing to do but feel sorry for myself. The Victoria Falls Hotel is one of those magnificent monuments to the great days of empire. Its walls are as thick as those of a castle, but painted brilliant white. The floors are of marble, with sweeping staircases and colonnaded porticos. The ceilings are cathedral-high with fancy plasterwork and gently revolving fans. The terraces and lawns stretch down to the very brink of the abyss through which the Zambezi River boils in all its fury and grandeur. Spanning the gorge is the delicate steel tracery of the arched bridge, of which Cecil Rhodes ordered, "I want the spray from the falls to wet my train as it passes on its way to the north." The spray hangs in a perpetual snowy mantle over the chasm, twisting and folding upon itself as the breeze picks at it, and always there is the muted thunder of falling water, like the sound of storm surf heard from afar. When David Livingstone, the missionary explorer, first stood on the edge of the gorge and looked down into the sombre, sunless depths, he said, "Sights such as these must have been gazed upon by angels in their flight." The Livingstone suite, which looks out upon the view, was named after him. One of the black porters who carried up their luggage told Janine proudly, "A King Georgie slept here, and Missy Elizabeth, who is now the Queen, with her sister Margaret when they were little girls." Rowley laughed. "Hell, what was good enough for King Georgie?" And he grossly overtipped the grinning porters and fired the cork from the bottle of champagne that waited for them in a silver ice bucket. They walked hand in hand along the enchanted path beside the Zambezi River, while the timid little spotted bushbucks scuttled away into the tropical undergrowth and the vervet monkeys scolded them from the treetops. They ran laughing hand in hand through the rainforests under the torrential downpour of falling spray. Janine's hair melted down her face, and their sodden clothing clung to their bodies. When they kissed, standing on the edge of the high cliff, the rock trembled under their feet, and the turmoil of air displaced by the volume of tumbling water buffeted them and flung the icy spray into their faces. They cruised on the placid upper reaches of the river in the sunset, and they chartered a light aircraft to fly over the serpentine coiling and uncoiling gorge in the noon, and Janine clung to Roland in delicious vertigo as they skimmed the rocky lip of the gorge. They danced to the African steel band under the stars, and the other guests, who recognized Roland's uniform, watched them with pride and affection. "One of Ballantyne's scouts," they told each other. "They're very special, the scouts." And they sent wine to their table in the manorial dining room to mark their appreciation. Roland and Janine lay late in bed in the mornings and had their breakfast sent up to them. They played tennis, and Roland lobbed his service and returned to her forehand. They lay in the sunlight beside the Olympic-sized pool and anointed each other with sun cream. In their brief bathing suits, they were magnificently healthy, clean young animals, and so obviously in love that they seemed charmed and set apart. In the evenings they sat under the umbrella spread of the great trees on the terrace and drank Pym's No. 1 cup and experienced a marvellous sense of defiance in flaunting themselves to the full view of their mortal enemies on the far side of the gorge. Then one evening at dinner the manager stopped at their table. "I understand that you are leaving us tomorrow, Colonel Ballantyne. We shall miss you both." "Oh, no," Janine shook her head laughingly. "We're staying until the 26th.
"Tomorrow is the 26th, Mrs. Ballantyne,"